Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. In this month's show, take a walk around the biggest galleries in the world without leaving home, and curl up with a good book inside a Netherlandish work of art. But we begin with the gallery's major exhibition, Jan Gossaert's Renaissance. One of the highlights is a portrait of a young man looking up from his paperwork in an office in which a pile of coins appear on his desk. It's a picture that says a lot about changing attitudes to business in the 16th century, as Leah Caribbean discovered when she met up with Angus Cameron, an expert in the histories and geographies of money. To start, they visited the permanent collection to look at a rather different depiction of the world of finance.
Angus, we're here in front of a work painted in about 1540 by the Netherlandish artist Marinus van Rijmersval, which shows two truly grotesque tax gatherers. The one on the left is very elderly with a downturned mouth and horrible sagging skin, and he's poring over an account book, while his companion on the right, well, he almost defies description. I mean, he's fixing us with this manic stare and pulling this horrible sneer, revealing very yellow teeth, and he has one claw-like hand advancing on a pile of gold and silver coins in the foreground. It's really not a very positive image, is it?
No, it's not. Tax gatherers is one way you could describe them. Perhaps more accurately, they are tax farmers. Throughout the Middle Ages, the collection of taxes was licensed to tax farmers who would bid for a license to collect taxes of a particular value. Once they had that license, they had free rein to go out and collect as much money as they could. Any money they got over the agreed sum was pure profit. So they were notorious for being ruthless in collecting money and quite brutal in doing so. With these two, the guy writing in the ledger is probably the tax farmer himself, and what he's writing is a list of the various taxes that he has license to collect. I think his partner, the ugly one with the clawed, veined hand over the money, is almost certainly the collector, who's the enforcer, if you like, who goes out and extracts the money from an unwilling public.
And so these two, I mean, they're extraordinarily dressed in these incredibly elaborate hats, very richly dressed as well. They've both got fur around their collars. And is this a form of sort of showing off? What is it?
I guess what the artist is trying to get across is the profligacy of these people. It's a kind of medieval bling. It's very bad taste. Everything's rather crude. If you look behind them, you can see all their paperwork is strewn across the top of a cabinet. It's all higgledy-piggledy all over the place. And there's a candle dripping wax everywhere. Very prominently on the candlestick is the scissors used to trim the wick, which they haven't done. They're just wasting the candle. It's all about waste and excess and moral depravity around the collection of money.
And what is this extraordinary pile of money that seems to be incredibly carefully painted in the bottom right-hand corner?
The coinage itself is interesting. The coinage here is, in a number of ways, poor money. If you look at it closely, it's cracked, it's split, it's cheap money. Although the money in the painting is quite clean, I suspect we're expected to take from this the fact that it's debased coin in which the silver has been diminished over time. This is cheap money. It's poor money in the other sense, in that this is the kind of money that your ordinary citizen might use, so therefore it is the money used by poorer people. Throughout the Middle Ages, effectively, you had a two-tier monetary system. The people at the top, the merchants, the bankers, and so on, would use gold coinages in their transactions, whereas ordinary people, and particularly the poor, would have these very low-grade coins worth virtually nothing that would circulate widely for ordinary transactions. The message it's sending out here is that these tax collectors are collecting money from the poor.
Now, while we're actually recording, the Gossaert exhibition is actually being hung, and among the star pictures is this stupendous image of a man, possibly a nobleman, called Jan Snoek, who's depicted in an office with paperwork and with money, but it's nothing like these tax collectors, is it?
No, what's striking about the comparison between these two pictures is that in both the Rijmersval and the Gossaert, the money occupies exactly the same position in the painting, in the composition. But the money in the Gossaert is clean. It gleams. Nice, big, shiny coins. These are high-value coins. Also, whereas in the Rijmersval, the claw-like hand hovers over the money. The money is a very important part of the overall composition. For Gossaert, he's kind of coolly ignoring it. He's looking at us. He's saying, you know, I'm okay. I've got this money. It's not a big deal for me. His paperwork is also very tidy.
So is it possible to see the Gossart portrait perhaps as a turning point in the depiction of money and business?
Well, one of the differences, the clear differences between the paintings is that whereas the Reimersvarl is moralising, it's very much decrying the love of money, the obsession with money, and in fact speaks to a very old debate about money, going right back to Christ kicking the moneylenders out of the temple. And so the Reimersvarl is a very popular image. People hated tax farmers. They did not like tax men, much as we don't like them now. Whereas the Gossart is a very different image. Obviously, it's commissioned by its sitter, so he's not going to present himself in these grotesque terms. But it's also perhaps a sign of the growing acceptance of the bureaucratic state. Particularly in the Low Countries, money comes to be a source of great power. The mercantile empires, particularly built around Amsterdam, the sort of empire of money, I suppose you could call it, around Bruges and the other big financial centres, depends on people accepting this as a legitimate part of developed society. Whereas in the past, money was deemed to be something satanic or devilish, and perhaps that's what Reimersvarl is appealing to. For Gossart, it's a calmer, more neutral, flatter, cooler image, where money is part of the general paraphernalia of power, of bureaucracy, and of government.
Thanks to Angus Cameron. Jan Gossart's Renaissance is open throughout the month. Tickets are available from the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Thanks to Google's Street View, you can take a walk down any road in the UK without leaving your home. Now the companies use the same tool to create the Google Art Project. From the Hermitage in St. Petersburg to MoMA in New York, you can take a virtual tour of major museums around the world. In addition, each institution has put forward one work to be scanned using super high-resolution technology. At the National Gallery, we picked Holbein's ambassadors for the honour, and every brushstroke's been revealed. To find out more, I met up with curator Susan Foister and Google's Amit Sood.
The Google Art Project brings together 17 museums from 9 countries, and what it does is it allows you to zoom, like never before, into the artworks that have been provided. But what's really new is also the indoor street view, which allows you to get an idea of the museum using street view technology. And finally, something that we've built called My Collections, which allows you to take your favorite bits off the site and share it with your friends.
Susan Foister, the work that has been selected from the National Gallery to be included at this really high resolution level is Holbein's Ambassadors. And forget megapixel, this is gigapixel technology, so visitors are able to see things that the human eye couldn't see. What do you hope that people will be able to get from this that they perhaps wouldn't have before?
Well, there are just so many details in this painting, and it's such an intriguing and a mysterious painting. So I think every time you come to it, you're probably going to see something different. And if you want to try and work out what all these objects are doing here, and people have been trying to work that out for a long, long time, you really need to be able to look at each one of them closely, whether it's the globe or the lute or some of the books or some of the details of what the two ambassadors are wearing. It's all here.
Could you point out a couple of things that perhaps people will be able to see?
Well, one detail I think that works really well and that you can't really see easily when you're standing in front of the painting is on the globe. If you zoom in to where France is, you can see this little dot indicating policy, and that's the chateau that Jean de Dinteville, the ambassador on the left, actually owned, and that's where the painting hung when he took it back home with him. Now, on an ordinary globe of this kind, you would never see such a tiny place, but he's clearly asked Holbein proudly to mark it out so everybody can see.
The one thing that people often notice about this work is the distorted object running diagonally. What will this project be able to tell us about that?
Well, I think one thing that I've never been able to see all that clearly before, because it's quite high up in the picture, is the other skull in the picture. So you've got this one here, and in the gallery you need to stand at right angles, and then the perspective of the skull suddenly snaps into focus. But if you're looking at this on Google, you can zoom into the hat of Jean de Dinteville, and you can see that he's actually got a hat badge of a skull, tiny little detail that's really difficult to see otherwise. And then you can start wondering, well, is it because of the hat badge that the bigger skull is in the painting? Why is it there? And then if you move across just to the left, you can see that semi-hidden silver crucifix, which is another great hidden feature of the painting.
Is one of the aims behind this project to encourage more people to enjoy the art and then get back into the museum?
Yes, I think, you know, what projects like these do is that they get art back into the mainstream audience, and I think that's really important. And apart from that, is you can have an emotional connection now, because when you come to a gallery and you see a painting, you have to move ahead quite quickly, but here you can really enjoy the ambassadors at your home and then come here and, you know, really see the thing in real life.
Well, I think this is going to give the opportunity to lots of people all over the world to experience something of the National Gallery's collection, and we hope that it's really going to inspire them to find out more about painting. There also, I think it shows that you can have different experiences of the paintings in the gallery. There's always going to be something very special about coming and seeing the real thing here. But there's also something very extraordinary about being able to peer down at paintings in the amount of detail that we can see the ambassadors in. And that gives people another kind of experience.
Susan Foister and Amit Sood. If you'd like to take a look for yourself, visit www.googleartproject.com. As you might know, it's World Book Day on the 3rd of this month. To celebrate, we invited the manuscript historian Catherine Reynolds along to the gallery to talk about a late 15th century work by the Netherlandish master Hans Memling. It's known as the Dunn Triptych, after the British patrons who commissioned it, Sir John and Lady Dunn. And like many Netherlandish works from this period, it features figures holding books. Sir John and Lady Dunn both appear, flanked by saints and kneeling in prayer before the Virgin and Child. Lady Dunn holds one book, the Virgin another, and it's with this second book, probably a Bible or devotional text, that Catherine Reynolds begins.
It is clearly an expensive object. It's got beautifully gilded edges. All the edges of the leaves are gilded and punched to make patterns. And you can see hanging down across the Christ Child's leg one of its leather clasps. These are needed to keep the book shut, because unlike modern bindings, these books were designed to be opened. You can see how Lady Dunn's book falls naturally, very easily open and flat for reading. Because they're designed to open, they then need clasps to keep them shut. Lady Dunn's book is a rather more simple object. It just has text in one column, not the two we can see in the Virgin's book, and is probably her prayer book or book of hours, the book of the prayers to be said at the different liturgical hours of the day. Women, of course, had far more time to spend at their devotions, that is, women of the upper class who were not engaged earning their livings. It's perhaps as a sign of this, their more passive role in society, those who can pray rather than the men who, in a literal sense, can go and fight, can go and make their way in the world, that Sir John simply clasps his hands in prayer, whereas Lady Dunn is occupied with her book. This was a suitable pastime for women, and women were very widely taught to read. In England, it was perhaps more for the upper classes, but in the Netherlands, literacy spread quite far down society, and many women engaged in business would have learnt to read and to count, and could then use those skills to pursue their spiritual enrichment. This is obviously a very three-dimensional object with its two wings that will fold over the centre panel. At this date, when rich textiles were the most prestigious way of covering the walls of a dwelling, paintings were not necessarily thought of as things to hang on walls. Some certainly did, but many others were positioned on dressers or were kept in bags to be brought out and looked at when wanted. In this way, they can be paralleled with books. Just as Lady Dunn's book, I'm sure, has pictures, when she's finished looking at it, she will fold it and put it away in a bag. Similarly, when people have finished their devotions in front of this triptych, it can be folded and closed, and a smaller painting could be kept in a bag just as a book could. In this painting, the books appear subsidiary to the main theme of Sir John and Lady Dunn's devotion to the Virgin and Child, but in terms of artistic activity in the Netherlands in the 15th century, they were not a subsidiary art form. Hans Memling isn't known to have painted in books, but some of the painters in the Netherlands did work as both panel painters and illuminators. And of course, there was enormous cross-fertilisation between the two forms of painting. Illuminators painting within a book had the margins around their paintings, which they could use, as well as the space actually defined by the frame of their miniature. I think this encouraged them to consider ways of linking the picture to the viewer. This encouraged a very sophisticated attitude between viewer and image, something that, of course, is also found in panel painting, where artists use fictive framing devices, parapets, archways, doorways, ways that would relate the painted image to the world in which the viewer stands to look at them. Manuscript illumination was vitally important, and paintings on panel can only rarely be understood when considered alongside the paintings in manuscripts.
Thanks to Catherine Reynolds. Dunn's triptych will be on display throughout the month. And if you're visiting, don't forget we're open 10 till 6 and 10 till 9 on Fridays. You can find details of all our exhibitions and events on the website, www.nationalgallery.org.uk. That's it for this episode. Until next month, goodbye.